We've all been there. The end of a busy day, we're at the shops trying to rush around, get groceries, and suddenly our child loses it. It can be over the smallest, most insignificant thing, but can cause a huge amount of stress in that moment and lots of attention from others, unwanted attention. Some parents really do deserve a gold medal with how they manage to control this situation. It can be extremely stressful for both the child and the parent. Tantrums can come like this without warning, or there can be some early indicators that they are emerging in that child's emotions. Today we're going to be talking about tantrums, emotional regulation and sensory processing disorder with our guest Lisa Cooper, who is an OT, occupational therapist, who specializes in child behavior, psychology and developmental problems. And Lisa has worked in both public and private settings. Lisa is passionate about working with children and their families and how to bridge the gap between physical and emotional health. She works alongside other health professionals to ensure that holistic assessment and intervention takes place.
Raising children can be one of the most challenging life journeys you will ever take. This is the Kids Health Network podcast, supporting happy, healthy children and demystifying common medical and psychological problems with experienced health professionals. Hosted by father of two and general practitioner, Dr. Andrew Leach.
Get in touch with us with ideas. Email Kids Health Network @outlook.com. The Kids Health Network is a support service for kids and their families. Please rate us on iTunes. Thanks for tuning in.
Tantrums can be very stressful experiences for both the caregiver and the child. They can escalate in a matter of seconds, even without reason sometimes. I wanted to explore tantrums further, both to understand them more and to learn strategies for them. Lisa Cooper is my special guest today. Thanks for coming, Lisa.
Thank you, Andrew, for inviting me.
I guess a good place to start here is why you think children have tantrums. And, I mean, sometimes it's obvious that something's been taken away from them or they're in trouble for something. But sometimes it can also be very subtle and very difficult to pick. So are there any sort of categories or good reasons why children actually have tantrums?
Well, that's a really big question, Andrew, because I think tantrums can happen for many reasons. I think that when we consider our children and their development, often there might be many invisible triggers throughout their day that we as parents in our business have probably not seen. I mean, essentially, tantrums are very normal, and it's a normal stage of development. It's probably one of the most awful things that we have to handle as parents. But it's really, I guess, really important to think around. It's normal, and how we respond to our children's tantrums is, I guess, really important in terms of how they can then start to learn to deal with their emotions and start to regulate themselves as they grow older.
So do you think there's no real one answer to that? There's no real exact trigger to them? It depends on their age and it depends on their development as to what a child might explode for. And I guess that leads on to, is there a common age group you would start to see this occurring more?
I guess with tantrums, Andrew, is that they're common equally across boys and girls, and they commonly happen between the ages of 18 months and 3 years. And I think at that age, their social and emotional skills are only just starting to develop. They're learning to deal with stresses and frustration, and it's something that is a skill that is learnt over time. So all children have tantrums, and as parents, you know, no one is perfect as a parent in terms of how we handle them either.
No.
But I suppose if we can start to understand what might be some of the causes, I guess it kind of helps us as parents in learning how to possibly prevent them, but also how we can help them in the moment, which we know is often the hardest thing with tantrums. It's when it's happening, whether privately or publicly, particularly hard when you're in a shopping centre and there's lots of things happening and lots of people looking at you when that happens.
It can be so stressful.
Oh, absolutely. And being a parent myself, I know how that feels. So, but we also know that that they can be really common in that 2-year kind of age where children's language skills are starting to develop. Often children at this age don't have the language skills to always say what they want or what they feel or need, and this can cause a lot of frustration for them. And so what we see is that tantrums are often an expression of, it's a way of communicating, it's an expression of these big emotions that they're getting overwhelmed with.
So the terrible twos is a true thing.
I think so, and possibly the threes as well, but they start to lessen, I suppose, when language skills start to improve and they can start to say how they're feeling and they have the words to start to explain that. And I think with children, often they, I guess, behaviour is an expression of emotions and of their needs. Yeah.
So developmentally at around that age, they're trying to get a message across, and that seems like the logical way for them to do it in terms of frustration, anger, disappointment. Whereas later on you're saying that that emotional response changes, they can verbalise it more rather than go into those sorts of moments, I guess. It never fully goes away. I find as my children are getting older, it's not fully disappearing, but it does lessen, as you say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think adults can still have tantrums, to be honest, Andrew. I think, if you think about it from a brain point of view, and I think there's a really lovely concept called the whole brain child that's by a psychiatrist in the States called Dan Siegel, and he has worked with a psychotherapist, Tina Payne Bryson, who look at the brain as in having two parts, an upstairs brain and a downstairs brain. And so if we think about the downstairs brain, it's actually the brain parts are called the brainstem and the limbic region, but essentially it's responsible for our basic functions like breathing and blinking, our reactions and impulses, but it's also very tied into what I think people are starting to learn more about, the fight or flight response. So it's where our strong emotions are driven from, and it's such an important part of our brain because it's where we have things like empathy and we learn to care from others. And I can think of that from like almost like a bottom-up aspect of how our brain works. But then, and when we're born, we're born with that downstairs brain. And if you think about like a house being renovated, the upstairs brain is still getting developed over time. And that is more our cerebral cortex, but that's when we're able to think, create and start to plan for things. We have what we call our higher order thinking. This is when we can have more informed decision making and planning over the body and emotions, and we start to understand ourselves, and we can use what we call more of a top-down approach. We can start to think about how we're feeling and how we respond to things, whereas I think the downstairs brain is very much in the moment. We're just reacting and responding to what's happening.
What age does the upstairs brain start to develop?
I guess it develops over time, and we're guiding that as parents. I think from birth to maybe, well, it's a constant development, but certainly that from to about 5 years is, as parents, we are really almost there. They're thinkers and they're planners. We're shaping how that develops over time, and we know, I guess when we think about formal learning and with going to schools, is that our children's cognitive skills are developing from around age eight. Just from my own experiences in working with children, is that I think their cognitive skills are developed at a point that they can start to really think about how they're responding to things, their regulation skills.
Yeah, and of course that's variable between children and even between girls and boys probably as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as you were saying before, is that sometimes there are different reasons why tantrums might happen. So it depends on the underlying factors that are kind of causing the tantrums too.
Yeah, with the upstairs and downstairs brain, it's a really nice sort of way of imagining the functioning of the brain and the emotional side of it.
Yes.
And even touching on things like anxiety, I talk to parents about how that downstairs brain sometimes takes over, even in the older children, that they lose that upstairs ability, that ability to actually control that worry and that anxiety and that stress that they might be having, and and therefore that flight or fight response is more persistent and invasive to how they're feeling. So it's another way of looking at that as well.
Absolutely. Yep. And if you think about that downstairs brain, that's where our amygdala is housed, and that is our inbuilt protection system. So if we sense danger or fear, that just fires up the body, and we get flooded with some neurochemistry. And when that happens, our thinking part of the brain is shut off. We're not in conscious control of what we're doing.
Just changing direction a little bit. Tantrums can come so suddenly and unpredictable and, you know, as you say, in public places, very difficult moments. You know, I can imagine some really, you know, moments that you just did not want that tantrum to occur. Like, is it ever possible to predict a tantrum that might happen or is going to happen? Or maybe the flip side of that is it ever possible to prevent a tantrum?
Absolutely. And I think it's how we understand our children. I think when children are more stressed or hungry or tired and they're more overstimulated, I'd say it's much harder for them to start to manage their feelings and behaviour. So I guess reading our children's cues around those times and looking at what we're doing at those times, it might not be the best time to go shopping around lunchtime because we know that that might be a time that they're feeling overwhelmed because they're not functioning at their best, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. End of a school day, you know, kids are often just exhausted and more little things will tip them over the edge.
Absolutely, and that's quite a common thing that we see, Andrew, is that our children can be really well behaved at school and suddenly they turn into this different child at home. And it's a really common thing that we hear from parents. And essentially they're tired. They might have been put under stress during the school day and are managing to kind of keep it together because we've got the expectation at school that we need to kind of do this. We've got the teacher influence. We've got our peers that we're working with. We've probably reached our threshold by the end of the school day. And often it's with the people that we feel the most safe with that sometimes these kind of behaviours can start to just spill out because we kind of start to unravel a little bit. So it's quite a common thing I hear, particularly around transitions times, like that car trip home or, yeah, going from one thing to another is often a time where a tantrum might also emerge.
And the newer rise of tantrums in the setting of technology, I think withdrawal of that technology, so it's okay going on, but I don't know if anything happens to the brain when they're using the technology, whether it hypes them up or whether it, I don't know how that works. And we're learning a lot about that. But the actual withdrawal, when it's time to stop using that technology, I know that's a very common trigger for a meltdown.
Absolutely. And I think you can give all the tips around saying you've got 30 minutes or you've got, you know, a 5-minute warning. But when it's actually in the moment, it's very... Children are displaying a lot of difficulty with transitioning off those iPad times. And I wonder, from a brain point of view too, is there's a lot of stimulation happening there. And when we think about that downstairs brain, when we think about calming strategies for the downstairs brain, it's around movement and breath. And so, yeah, I wonder if when they're on those gaming devices, is if the brain's just so stimulated that they're not able to switch into their good choices.
Regulation is a buzzword as well at the moment. And self-regulation. Can you tell me what that actually means?
Absolutely. So I kind of see self-regulation is essentially our ability to be able to deal with everyday stresses and problems effectively and efficiently and then return back to a baseline of feeling more calm and focused. I guess when we think about with our kids' regulation, the better our kids can shift from being stressed or frustrated or to being back into that calm and focused state, I guess the better their self-control and the better their self-regulation. So it's how we can manage, understand and manage our own behaviours and reactions, I suppose.
How do we teach kids to self-regulate? Is there a way to do it? I also wanted to just touch on the side that I think it's important to recognise that these emotions are sometimes normal, that, you know, a child experiencing extreme anger or sadness or stress or, you know, it can actually be a normal emotion. It's tricky, this question, but, like, when does it become abnormal and how do we help them to regulate better? It's really quite tricky.
Absolutely. And I think from that is that I think, you know, our emotional regulation skills are something that develop over time again. And I think as parents, when our kids do experience those big emotions, that can sometimes be quite uncomfortable for us too as parents, but it is a normal part of development. And they need to learn also from us that those feelings of frustration and anger or sadness or fear are normal emotions that they can get through and they're okay. And I think it's how we respond as parents to that in terms of how we can help to calm them and support them through those moments, helps them to realise actually all feelings are okay and we can learn ways, some tools to manage that.
So I mean, in a tantrum, what can parents do then to help with the child in that moment, as you say, that they're using that word? And I mean, there's different strategies. Every child is different with what they might respond to. And sometimes it's just about being with the child that, you know, is all you can really do, because that brain is stimulated so much or is firing off. There is no rational word you can say that's going to help to settle things. But Is there anything you can do, or do you have any tips for parents?
Absolutely, Andrew. And I think it's really nice to think of tantrums from a downstairs brain versus an upstairs brain perspective. I think when we've spoken about the downstairs brain is that these are big emotions that are overtaking our body. Our thinking part of the brain is not working as effectively as it should be. So what we actually need to do as parents is being able to not join the chaos of our child's emotions, but being able to be with them during that and to be able to connect before we can redirect. Mm. And often that can be is actually thinking about things like our tone of voice, like we might reduce talking is an important aspect, because we know that if the thinking part of the brain shut off, too much talking is actually just starts to overstimulate and not help at all. Mm. Thinking about a less stimulating environment, that can be hard if you're in a shopping centre. But as much as possible, say, for example, if you're home, go into an environment where there might be less people around, you might have more dim lighting. You're just trying to create more of a calm space for them. And I think teaching, just being with our child through the tantrum, it's not yet, as I said, it's not the time to reason or distract. When our big feelings have set in, our kids aren't in that rational mode of thinking. We need to be consistent. We need to be calm. We need to acknowledge that difficult feeling that they're experiencing and help them through that. So allow them time to calm down, go for a walk with them, sit with them, hold them, hug them, prompt them to make a good choice, but state clearly and firmly that they're okay and that you're with them at the moment. It might be later that you then might reflect on what's happening with them, but in the midst of the tantrum, I guess it's really important that you're just staying with them and calming them.
Mm.
Yeah.
I find also that tantrums can have an effect on the parent in terms of that emotion can brush off on you and it can make you feel very on edge and agitated and, you know, you feel like you need to escalate yourself to control the moment, and recognizing that, you know, you might be feeling that way and that you need to also try and be a role model for that child. It's not easy, and show what calming down looks like and remain calm. And sometimes it doesn't even involve words, just simple actions. So that they're really nice ideas. It often takes practice, it takes time, and it's not always easy.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think something that's really important is to remember that tantrums, particularly the downstairs tantrums, they're not deliberate. The current situation is overwhelming our kids in terms of the demands that are on them in any given situation is outweighing the resources they have to deal with what's going on.
Mm.
So I think it's even having that a bit of a mantra in our mind saying, actually, it's not in their control, it's not deliberate, this is overwhelming for them. And yes, it's making, I'm feeling angry, I'm feeling frustrated, but it will pass. It does get better, it does get easier. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all really nice, but is it ever deliberate?
I think it can be. I think that when we talk about the brain, I think that upstairs tantrums can be intentional tantrums, and it can be a way of a child trying to get some control over a situation, and it can be quite a conscious choice to act out to get a reaction or a response that they desire. For some children too, they know how to push our buttons until they get the desired response. But a big thing is within that, you can actually say they're able to control their emotions and body, and they're actually able to make some decisions around that. So it's coming from a place of strategy, not coming from a place of intense emotion, I suppose. And I guess then you would actually respond to it quite differently as you would to the downstairs brain. This would not be a tantrum to negotiate in. They actually need a firm boundaries and a clear discussion. For example, if you're in a shopping centre and your child really wants those shoes that they really want, but you can see actually part of it is around their control and they're expecting a response. And if they up the ante, then maybe those shoes will be bought for us. So that it does require some firm limits at that time, respectful communication, that they actually have to be reminded of what would be expected and unexpected behaviours for a situation.
There's some emotions that do need some learning and some teaching and some guidance. I mean, those older age kids, as you said, from primary school onwards, tend to need that understanding from an older figure. And so whilst we've cotton-wooled it a little bit with the younger kids and just being present and understanding, I think sometimes you do need to have limits. Yeah, definitely.
And I think for children too, that gives them a sense of safety and security. They know what to expect from us as parents as well. So that's an important part of...
They look to you for guidance on that, I guess. maybe not.
Absolutely.
Because they're in the moment of buying shoes, they know how to manipulate that situation as well.
Absolutely. And I think there might be quite subtle cues that you need to tune into. But I think a downstairs tantrum is very different. I think we can really see our child's no longer able to think clearly. There's a lot of stress hormones flooding in, and they might start to arch their back, or their breathing might change. They might start to have more of that. Lots of, you know, intense crying, screaming, kicking, which could be an upstairs tantrum too. But I think there's a bit of the flooding of emotions, and that body response can be a bit more extreme or intense with that. Yeah.
Is there ever a point where a child is having too many tantrums, and how do we work that out?
It depends on the child's age. When we might actually need to seek some help is if, I guess, tantrums are happening more often, they're more frequent, and they're just... They're lasting, yeah, for much longer than what we would expect to be quite normal. And I guess too, as a parent, if you're really feeling overwhelmed and stressed and out of control when those tantrums are happening, it might be a time that to get a bit of assistance or guidance might help you through that as well.
And your children can pick up on that.
Absolutely.
That you might be struggling. And it's, you know, opportunity time to... you know, to play into that. So it's also important you recognise yourself, how you're coping with them.
And recognising when there might be those kind of bad feelings between you and your child, that's the time that you might need to help it to get through this kind of stage. It might just be a stage, or it might be a little bit more, but I think it's important that you do seek help. And I guess too is if your child always kind of appears to be a little bit more irritable or defiant or oppositional, a bit more rigid or not cooperative, it might be a sign they're feeling the stresses around them are intense, and they don't have the resources to deal with them, and they might need some support to actually start thinking, what are some of the underlying reasons why these are happening, why are these occurring, I suppose.
What are some of those reasons that could be happening?
There's many reasons why this could be happening. And I guess from our practice at Inside Out, we often see children having difficulties with their self-regulation skills, and it might be because of, say, their underlying temperament. They might be a bit more prone to being anxious or irritable. They might be having some difficulties with their sensory processing, which is around how they respond to the sensation from the environment and how they regulate that sensory input in their bodies. Or it could be even their relationship, as we said, with their parents or caregivers. The other thing that we need to consider for our children is actually what their developmental stage is and what their skill levels are. Are we asking too much of them, and do they not have the skills to execute that? I think, Andrew, you were sort of saying before, sometimes when we see our kids at the end of the school day and they might be a bit more irritable, that might be a bit of a time where a tantrum might happen. If we think about what's been asked of them during the school day, that some of our kids are struggling with, say, their motor skills, their handwriting, and we're asking them from an educational point of view to be doing all these activities that actually might be exceeding what their skill level is. And I think that can cause that internal stress response.
There's
as
a lot
well.
More pressure on kids now, isn't
absolutely,
there?
Absolutely. And particularly for, you know, our younger kids, that can be really hard for them. They are trying to do well. They're trying to kind of keep it all together, and it comes at a point that those invisible triggers are building up during the school day, and they tend to then come out later, and it can be more in those big emotions and those big responses.
Are there any risk factors in the home environment that might lead to a very emotional child? That's a big question.
Absolutely. I know that there could be things happening within a family level. There could be stresses around... I guess parents arguing, or there might be an arrival of a new sibling that might happen that might upset how the child's feeling in terms of their security within that family system. As parents, we might be having our own difficulties and stresses. I think life is particularly busy now, and there's a lot of pressure on us as parents, and I think sometimes that can... Often our children are sponges, and they can soak in what's happening on a family level that can cause... some stress and difficulty regulating our emotions.
I often get asked, is there something wrong with my child? They're always having tantrums, they're very difficult, they're often angry, or they're defiant even. That's a difficult question in a health setting to answer. So I guess looking at the whole child, their development, the other factors, as you mentioned, risk factors for what might be going on at home or school, really delving into their world and how they interact with that world. So there's a lot of other aspects to understanding the child who is struggling emotionally. And I think that takes time and takes a lot of expertise like yourself to get involved.
And I think too, we do need to think of it holistically and start to be the detectives of why this behaviour is occurring and start to unpack things. And I guess from a professional point of view, we can help parents start to kind of unpack some of these, the different areas. And it might be in one area, it might be across a couple of areas, but we can start to then, if we can start to identify the reason why, I guess we can really help to develop some good ideas and strategies to support and boost up a child's resources in how they're dealing with their emotions. Mm. And also empowering the families to build up their resources as well. Mm. So often when we work with our children in the clinic, we are working with parents and families too.
Mm. And just to mention, there are some diagnoses here that are, you know, important to consider when a child is struggling. And I've done podcasts on these, and that's the autism, the ADHD and the anxiety areas. So it might be worth people listening to those if they're a bit more worried about more specific causes of a child having emotional difficulty. But sticking to tantrums as a whole, I think you did mention sensory processing in there, and I'm really interested in that topic. It seems to be something that's becoming a little bit more commonly labelled or used. What is sensory processing? And is that actually a disorder, or is that just a child that's very sensitive, or what is that?
Sensory processing is certainly becoming a lot more common now. And I always think of sensory processing, it can be like a preference. As individuals, we all operate from different amounts of sensory stimulation to how we best operate. So for some people, they may be more sensitive to what's going on in their environment. For other people, they need more sensation to operate more effectively. So sensory processing is essentially the way our bodies notice, respond to and use sensory information. And it's coming from more of that downstairs brain point of view again, Andrew. Mm-hmm. So sensory input can be visual. It can be what we see, auditory, what we hear, our touch or tactile sensation, which can be either light or deep pressure touch. Vestibular, which is our movement sensation. Proprioception, which is not always as commonly known, but that's almost like our traction or our compression of a joint. So it's almost our internal body sense. Gustatory, which is our taste, and olfactory, our smell. And so essentially sensory integration is when the sensory input from our bodies and our environment is put together and it's sort of sorted out and then used so we can make an adaptive and appropriate response in a situation. And so we use sensory information to help us maintain a calm or focused state. Hmm. But I think when you were sort of saying, is it a disorder, I think it depends on how much it's affecting our functioning as to whether we'd label that a disorder. I think with sensory processing, we know that we do have some children that are more sensitive, what we call oversensitive, and we do have our children that are more undersensitive. And I think if it's impacting on their ability to manage their impulses and reactions, I think we can start to see and start to map out how they're responding to that sensory information, then it could kind of tip into that what we call a sensory modulation disorder or a sensory discrimination disorder. So a sensory discrimination disorder would be a specific sensory system, such as our auditory processing, they might be having difficulty with processing that information. Whereas a sensory modulation disorder is more around how all that input's being processed in our brain and how that's affecting then how we modulate our emotions and our behaviour. Mm. Yeah,
it's tricky.
It's a complex process. Mm. We can look at it quite in a simple term, but it's actually very complex, and it's happening in the brain all the time.
Have you got any examples of how that might look in a child?
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you think about a child that might be more sensitive to noise, they might startle easily unexpected or loud noises. They may really struggle when it's like assembly time at school, when the dog's barking at a shopping centre, they might be getting overwhelmed when there's a lot of busyness around them. Or, for example, kids that might have some difficulties in processing their vestibular or their movement sensation, they might either, I guess if they're undersensitive, they might seek out more movement. They need to be moving all the time. They're the kids that we see as being on the go and constantly active. But if they're undersensitive, they may actually be not as engaged in their environment. They might not be actually seeking out as much movement. They might be more lethargic or more sedentary.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what would you do? Is it best for an occupational therapist to help with these children, or
absolutely
psychologists?
Absolutely, yeah. I think an OT is actually we're really trained in the sensory processing model, and we do what we call a sensory profile, and we map out with the parents and children, depending on their age, how they respond through various questions, how they're responding to all their sensory input, and then we start to then be able to see if there's any patterns or tendencies occurring. So Is a child, do they have more of a what we call a low threshold? Are they an oversensitive child? Do they need a little bit of, like, do they have a small cup that when they start to get filled up with sensation, it starts to overspill, and that's when we might see more that anxiety response, or when it starts to overfill, they're feeling like things are too much for them, and it actually taps them into a fight or flight response. Whereas if a child has more of a high threshold to sensory information, then they're undersensitive, they need more of it. They've got a big cup that needs lots of filling, so they might need more opportunities to engage in their environment. Mm. And what we can do is, if we can kind of map out what our sensory profile is, we can start to help parents look at their routines and how we can, I guess, either modify the environment or put in more healthy and calming stimulation, sensory stimulation during the day.
Mm, almost building it up much slower. I think of the fussy child, and not necessarily sensory processing disorder, but do struggle with the sensation of certain foods. And so you might have to start small with this sort of situation rather than jump straight to the full, you know, meal that you're having as a family.
Yes.
And that might be the case with a lot of these other sensations, or trying to dull the overwhelming sensation that they're experiencing. Like you said, I think sensory processing is fascinating, and we probably should spend another podcast talking about it.
Talk about it. And there's so many areas of sensory processing, and as you were saying, it's actually becoming a lot more known now. And I think it's certainly and what I think's beautiful, when you think about that upstairs, downstairs brain, is that we know the part of the brain that processes emotion is also processing sensation. So we can use sensation in a really effective way to help build our emotional regulation skills.
Okay. We're coming to the end, Lisa, of our chat. In summary, how does an occupational therapist help children and families dealing with tantrums? And just if a parent's interested in going to see an OT, what might they expect that you do as a role?
Oh, absolutely. And I guess from some of what we've already discussed, Andrew, that we'd do a fairly thorough assessment to start to unpack all the different factors that might be contributing to, I guess, the child's, if we're thinking that the tantrums are happening more often than normal, then I think we can start to look at the different factors in the life, be that relationship, sensory processing, their temperament, their cognitive skills, and whether some children are actually a bit more rigid and they're not as flexible with how they process the world. So we start to then, if we can figure out the factors, we can start to have a really good intervention approach. And that might be, for example, helping parents develop a sensory diet. So how do we put in healthy sensation during the day? We also do a lot of work around teaching kids some self-management tools. So we have a lovely, some programs called the Alert Program, which is around teaching children what self-regulation is through a driving analogy, like thinking about regulation from an engine speed point of view. Is sometimes we can rev too fast, which might be around when we rev too fast, we might be more hyper in our movements, but we also might be more frustrated or angry. Sometimes we can rev too slow, and that's when we might be more lethargic, we might be sad, or we might not able to we're more in that slow speed. And then we want children to start to recognise what being just right might look like and what might feel like, and looking at it from both a feelings and a body point of view. And then we link in what we call the zones of regulation. So it's a really lovely way of mapping with children what the different arousal levels are. And again, using a similar engine speed kind of analogy, is that the green zone is when we're feeling calm, we're focused, we're ready to learn, we're feeling in a good space. And if we think about green as in terms of traffic lights, green is good to go. Then we go into that yellow zone, which is almost like our warning kind of zone, where our engine's starting to rev up, things are starting to feel a bit faster in our body. It might be around anxiety, it might be around a bit of frustration, it might be that we're starting to feel a bit silly and a bit hyped. Mm. And then we move up to the red zone. So if we think about red, like a stop sign, is that then when the big feelings set in?
Mm.
Is that all those angry responses, terrified can be one, feeling really mad. And then on the other hand, we've got the blue zone, which is around that's our rest zone. That's when we're actually feeling like our body is needing to restore and rejuvenate. So we teach kids ways of being able to recognise their body and their emotions within those zones, start to learn what some of their triggers are for those changes in zones, and then giving them some tools to cope with what's going on when they're facing problems or facing stresses.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, that's probably just as educational for the parents as it is for the child.
Absolutely. it often is a whole family approach. Mm. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I think in summary, please see someone for help if you're struggling in any way with this area. It's a tricky area. It can be very, very stressful. We're very lucky to have allied health support, psychology, OT, when things are not going as well as we'd hoped. And don't suffer in silence. Please come and see a GP and get some help around tantrums. So thank you so much, Lisa. You've been fantastic today. It's really, really interesting. I could talk for more, ask more questions, but we have to finish up and maybe some of those topics that we talked about, we meet again to discuss.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's been lovely to chat and, thank you again.
This has been another Kids Health Network podcast. The information and advice provided here is for general purposes only. It is not an alternative to the medical advice offered in person by your GP, paediatrician, or other health professional relating to you or your child's specific condition. If you have concerns that you or your child is acutely unwell, please seek immediate medical attention. For more, find us on Facebook or Instagram at Kids Health Network.